So I always said the first million, it's done by pure hard work from the entrepreneur, right? A lot of hours and put a lot of energy to get to a million. Once you pass the million, you have to start learning to be more efficient and more intelligent the way you work. And that's when masterminds really start providing a difference in value. It's been the most important thing that I've done in my life.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Selling with Love podcast. Today, I have a great friend that's going to be joining me, someone that I've had the pleasure to record content with on the Mind Valley platform, speaking about the different stages an organization goes through and what are the different requirements, mindset, teams, priorities. Everything really changes when you hit these certain markers within your organization. So if you're just getting started, maybe you've grown to a part where you're not hitting that next level, he's going to show you some of the things you need to be aware of that'll get you more aware of where you stand and what are the big blockers that get in the way. Daniel Marcos is the one joining me today. He's a serial entrepreneur, CEO, coach, international keynote speaker, and dedicated to helping business leaders scale their companies efficiently and sustainably. He's the co-founder CEO of Growth Institute. It's a leading online education platform. I'm actually one of their faculty members on the platform, teaching them on selling with love. And the man himself, Daniel, has supported over 70,000 executives in more than 70 countries to implement the frameworks of scaling up and how to build self-managed organization. He has an experience in finance and various other industries, but today he's going to be sharing with us. Daniel, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Amigo, thank you. Happy to be here.
You have always been someone that I look up to, someone that I enjoy every conversation. We usually talk about certain books. You've always recommended me the right ways to be guided. And I'm going to ask you a question that's off my non-usual questions, which is, when you got started in business, did you have anybody that was there giving you advice, guiding you, and that was a bit of an inspiration for you?
So when I started, I had a lot of uncles. I am from Mexico originally, but all my family's from immigrants. So they're all entrepreneurs. My father was the only one of his family that was a government employee. So all my uncles and cousins and all had business owners, and they all kind of guide me and give me a lot of ideas. But then when I really started building scalable companies, more tech companies, they did not have the expertise. And I joined EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization, and that's where I met the people that really guide me. And after a year I joined a program, and it's EO program called Birthing of Giants in MIT, led by Bart Harnish. And that really changed everything. He puts me in a room with 70 entrepreneurs from all over the world, amazing companies. There's several from that group that, by the way, in that moment, they were doing 5, 10, 20 million revenue. There's a couple of billionaires already from my class, and people that have built really big companies. So that's where I started getting all my guidance from that group.
You know, I hear this concept of like mastermind groups a lot. And I feel like today there's a lot of them, but it's almost like when marketers understood you can make money selling masterminds, now it seems like there's some everywhere. And I don't know why, Daniel, but I feel like half of them are crap. I'm skeptical about
more than half
that. And yeah, like when you did that, it wasn't so common that people were trying to put you into masterminds. The value proposition was very different.
Very different. And continues to be very different. Just to give you an idea, EO, I think I was paying like $4,000 a year. Today, I pay like $6,500. It's the cheapest mastermind out there and is the one that gives you the most value. We're 20,000 members worldwide, self-organized in like 80 countries. It's crazy. We have international events. We have training, private training for EO members in MIT, in Harvard, in INSEAD, in Kellogg, like the best universities in the world. And we have programs that are tailored to us at these universities. Like, what other mastermind has this access? None.
Daniel, I'm hearing about masterminds and it's like 20,000, 40,000, 100,000 masterminds to be in like a war room, not to poke on war room, but I know that's one of them. And it has its value. But like, at what point do you start looking for these types of opportunities? And I know EO is a great one, but what are some of the green flags you should look for if you're looking for that kind of mentorship?
So I always said the first million, it's done by pure like hard work from the entrepreneur, right? You have to work a lot of hours and put a lot of energy to get to a million. once you pass the million, you have to start learning to be more efficient and more intelligent the way you work. And that's when masterminds really start providing a difference in value. I've been a member of these organizations for 27 years now, 25 years now. And I could say it's been the most important thing that I've done in my life. Just to give an idea, back then, 1998, when I started my first business in Mexico, there was not even one venture capital company or fund in the whole country. Like, there was no angel investors, no nothing. So how do you raise money? Like, where do you talk with entrepreneurs? I thought I was crazy. I was 3 years out of college and I was raising $50 million from investors and doing all these things. And all my friends were trying to grow the corporate ladder in the typical big corporations, or they were being kind of self-employed and do gigs on the street, that it was very difficult to do gigs back then compared to today. And I was flying to New York to raise money from JP Morgan. I was having due diligence with Banco Santander. Like, who teaches you that? And that was what I learned in masterminds.
Wow. So you said something that I think is a great distinction to make, is you talked about people that were self-employed, and you used the term entrepreneur with a very different definition than what most people, I think, assume, because the majority of people that are just using the term entrepreneur is anybody who's self-employed. So could you talk about those differences and why it's important to differentiate them?
There's three types of entrepreneurs in the world. The first one is the one we call a mountain climber. Someone who wants to do something big, right? Vishal Lakhiani, mountain climber, from my imagine. I'm a mountain climber. Elon Musk. By the way, I have nothing compared to him, but people that want to do big things, right? When you're talking to someone and they talk about the dream and the impact, when you mentioned in my introduction, I'm very proud that I have clients in 70 countries around the world, right? Those are the numbers or things that, for me, pays me more than money. That's because of who I am. The second one is the entrepreneur we call a freedom fighter. And a freedom fighter, they want to do something that they own or they control. They don't want to work for anyone else. And they say, I want to build my own company so I could have freedom. And they want financial freedom, but most importantly, freedom of who I work with, when I work with, in what do I work with, and just be able to have their own freedom. And those entrepreneurs usually build a lifestyle business. Yes, they're an entrepreneur, but it's a very different business that they build compared to the mountain climb. And then you get the third one. And the third one is like an artist, or they call them the crafts people. They do art, and then they have two options. Or they own it and control it, and they stay like a freedom fighter. And you see this in every market in Thailand or Bali, this family, or they just put a very small stand. They do their own art, and they sell their own art. But they're usually very small companies, 10 employees, maximum 5 to 10 employees. Or they partner with mountain climbers to do big things. Steve Jobs was an artist. His art was building technology. But he said, I want my technology to go to every hand. So I have to partner with mountain climbers for them to sell it and make it big. But he always stayed on the product side, on the marketing of the product. So, and the way he talked about himself, he had this phrase, very famous, great artist still. He was a great artist. That's the way he saw himself. So those are the three types. The second one could be called entrepreneur, or could be called a self-employed. They just want to do something small, no risk, no salaries, no drama, just to have a lifestyle. And they have a great life. This is my fifth company. First one was a huge success. Second was a big failure. And after that, I became a consultant. And I'm a consultant, but I was doing really good money and I was working half time and I had an assistant and that was it. And it was very easy. Life was easy and I was making a lot of money. I was very present with my family. And one day I went with my wife and said, I'm going to build my third company. And my wife was like, are you crazy? And I was like, no, like I'm a mountain climber. I need to do another one. And she was like, we have our best years today that you're a consultant. You have no salaries, no risk, no drama. How can you even think about building another one? And I was like, a mountain climber has to do another one. You're a freedom fighter. That's my wife's style. And for her to think to build another scale up, it was a crazy idea. And I've built two scale ups since. And I love it. But that's why.
I feel like you need a slight level of crazy to go through the things you need to make a scale-up scale-up.
You have to. 100% agree.
I think that's actually some really good categories because I find that majority of the people might have a freedom fighter spirit, but are listening to mountain climber advice. And I feel like that might actually put them in the wrong camp to learn.
So I have a talk that I go through the five stages and what you have to do and blah, blah. And I build it to tell scale up or mountain climbers how to climb efficiently or with more organization. And it's interesting, whenever I get out of the stage, the people that get the most value and come on to the stage and hug me and say, you changed my life, are freedom fighters. They said, you gave me the framework to be independent and stay here and be happy. In the speaking world, by the way, most of the speakers are freedom fighters. And indeed, Vern Harnish, my partner and mentor, he's an artist more than anything. His art is writing books, writes amazing books. He's an amazing speaker. But if you see his company, he's a company with 2-3 employees. But he licensed his IP to companies like mine, we're mountain climbers, to take care everywhere. And we have 300 mountain climbers scaling it, right? So he has a worldwide reach, over 100 million of revenue, but he just has 2-3 employees. And everything's done through other mountain climbers. So when we build the talk and when my objective was to give structure to scale up, as you mentioned, it's really, really hard to do a scale up and you have to be a little bit crazy to do a scale up. And the people that really get the most value is the freedom fighter. And they say, you gave me the right and you give me the mental stability or feel comfortable to stay on stage two and don't go to stage three. Indeed, most of them stay on stage one and they feel very, very happy. My wife, she has told me, my happiest years with you is when you had a company stage one and you didn't have any risk. And we could go on vacation 2 months a year and you were making a lot of money, but it was just, you know.
But then you still have an itch and a purpose and you have a mountain. You can't take that out of your DNA. And that's maybe where I wanted to ask you is like, for the mountain climber attitude, is it something you're born with that you have to have that itch? And like, should you be aspiring to be a mountain climber? No, I'm definitely relating more to being a freedom fighter. And I'm wondering if there's something wrong with me.
No. That's what they told me. I thought there was something wrong with me until I heard your talk. And now I realize I'm normal. But they thought there was something wrong. That's exactly the phrase I hear. No, you're perfect. Indeed, if you push yourself to be a mountain climber or do a scale up, you're going to get out of your comfort zone. You're going to hate it. And you're going to implode your company because you don't want to do it. It's too much risk. So the mountain climber, So my wife always says, and this the conversation I have with other, how can you be crazy and dumb enough to do a scale up? But if you see the progress in the world, it's done by mountain climbers. Like Tesla, you could not do cars even on a mountain climber. You could not be, Henry Ford could not have been a freedom fighter and Bill Ford, right? All these big companies in the world that provide all the services, products, airlines that you fly all the time, they were built by mountain climbers. So the big impact, the big changes in the world, they're really done by mountain climbers. You have someone that is an inventor. They invent something, but you still have to scale it. Let's talk about electricity, right? So electricity was invented by an inventor, but who's the one that really took it to the world? J.P. Morgan or J.P. Morgan. That was the guy that put all the money and put all the risk and did the big company and did electricity and Niagara Falls and all that. That's done by mountain climbers. I think the world needs the mountain climbers to do all the progress and the big change to the world.
And in my case, I love working with mountain climbers. Like I find that there's such a great symbiosis between aligning myself with a mountain climber and getting rid of some of their problems so they can climb higher. And I get to still express my freedom fighter values and provide value. Like this becomes beautiful.
I have a lot of freedom fighters around my company. A lot of my marketing campaigns and all that are done by freedom fighters. They're great. They're doing what they do.
I had not heard of this framework and duality. And I think it explains a lot of different attitudes between the types of people you work with and what they bring in and how they work.
I learned this from John Warlow, Built to Sell.
Hmm. Yep.
He's the one that teaches it.
Well, that's always something we have great conversations about, is you always recommend me the best books. You always have the best resources and the right people to learn from. And one of the things I find very interesting, again, in our conversation, is you spoke about the types of companies that go in through stage one is all the way to making a million. And I want to zoom in on that and just talk about the difference between aiming for a goal of making 100,000 versus a goal of making a million in business. Since I see that there's a lot of messaging out there that's trying to push a formula of freedom by doing entrepreneurship, where people are being told, get to make six figures. And I'd be curious to know, is there things you've noticed with the people that are chasing to make the hundreds of thousands versus someone with a goal of a million, and the different obstacles they'll face based on the target they've set?
Yes. So let me walk you a little bit through the stages. I think that will explain a lot of that. I'm talking stages of a scale-up, but I will kind of walk you through how a freedom fighter sees it differently. So stage one, it's a company that needs to figure out product market fit, right? 1 to 5 employees, you need to figure out if you have a market out there. Hey, am I able to produce a product or a service efficiently enough that my client wants to buy? If I produce it too expensive, I won't be able to sell it. Or if I produce it with very low quality, my client won't buy it. I have to be able to produce efficient enough for my client to buy. Product market fit. And usually you have to prove product market fit on stage one. What a freedom fighter does in stage one is really trying to figure out if he has a business and the business is going to be able to maintain his quality of life. But it's a business 5-7 employees maximum. You're kind of figuring out and making sure you have a business and say, okay, yes, I have a business. Now I start scaling and I start getting more employees and the rest. You get to stage two. And in stage two, you have a cash flow problem. Your expenses are stable and growing up, and your revenue is very unstable. So if you're a freedom fighter, you said, this is not worth it. I have too much drama. I have to be selling. I have to be doing everything. So the true freedom fighters figure out to build a predictable revenue model that their employees could run without them. The thing that they want is just get me out of the middle of the operation so I could really enjoy the life that I want. It's not about making money. They do make enough money usually at that stage. It's just they have a lot of drama. I don't know if you remember the first book that really explained this, 4-Hour Workweek. Tim Ferriss, he's a freedom fighter, right? Tim Ferriss, he had a company. He was doing very good money, but he hated that he had to work 20 hours a day. So that's when he goes to England to decompress and in 4 months goes back to 4 hours a week. But he told us in that book that he could get a much bigger company. He just didn't want to. He was happy with the money he was making. He just wanted to work 4 hours a week. And that's why that book was so popular, because he gave a mental framework for a freedom fighter to stay there and how to automate their company so they could really enjoy their lifestyle. That's why it was so, so popular. So in stage two, the freedom fighter says, remove the day-to-day from me or as much as you can so I could really have freedom and I could really enjoy my lifestyle. The mountain climber said, I want to do this scalable. I need to make a replicable model so I could really scale my sales. And the objective of the mountain climber is get speed on sales so they could really continue to go to the next stage. So very different points of view. But the main thing on stage two is figuring out how to replicably and stably sell your products or services. And that's where you start building all the funnels and all the social media and all that. And now you said, hey, if I have a video and I get 1 million views, I'm going to get 100 leads and I'm going to sell 5, right? And that's the typical funnels that we're putting through, I would say. Then you get stage three. And by the way, if you're a freedom fighter, you do not go to stage three. You stay on stage two. You have to stay on stage two. You will hate your stage three if you're a freedom fighter. Indeed, remember you and I in COVID, there was this group of internet marketers that Evan Pegg and I think put together, and we had several calls. And I presented this for the first time there. And I get a call from an entrepreneur from the group like 2 hours later after my presentation. And he said, oh my God, you just showed my last 10 years of my life in 20 minutes. I didn't understand, and I was feeling terrible of what I did with my company. And now I understand why. He had a company, 60 employees, and he was hating his company, hating it. And one day he woke up and said, I'm done. I'm going to implode my company. I'm going to take it down to 20 that I feel comfortable. And he fired 40 employees and took it down to 20. And he said, I'm the happiest kid in the block with 20 employees. He didn't understand the framework that he was a freedom fighter. And he was in the middle of the valley of death of stage 3 scale up. He just did not like it. And then he had to come back. So that's kind of the way they see each other. If you're a mountain climber, you have to go to stage 3. And stage 3, I call it, it's the main valley of death for a company because it's the adolescent phase. You come from a company that is run very unprofessional, stage 1 and stage 2, more family-oriented. I take decisions because that's what I want, right? It's not what I try for the company. I'm going to take a decision for me. When you go to stage 3, you start getting managers and you start getting departments, org charts, and it gets much more complicated. Stage 3 company, but now you start to invite other leaders and you become a leader of leaders and leading through other leaders. So there's a lot of communication problems and things like that. But you have to start respecting the other managers. Until stage 2, everyone's a frontline employee and you take decisions, you don't really care. When you would say 3, imagine I hire a financial controller and the financial controller puts a system or a process for me to pay techs or vendors. I have to respect that process. If I break the process, my controller is going to say, I'm out, right? You ask me to put systems or processes. I put systems or processes and you break them all. So the company stops being about you and stops building about the leadership team and the team really operating all together or uniquely, let's say. So the most important part of stage 3 is first is you have to hire managers. So in stage 1, who do you hire? Generalists, people that want to do everything. They're not good doing one thing. They just put a lot of energy. They have a great attitude and they do everything. And if you ask them to buy and to sell, to go to the supermarket, to clean the toilet, they will do it because they're not great doing one thing. In stage 2, because you want to start making things replicable and things like that, you start hiring specialists. And a specialist is very, very good doing one thing, but they just do one thing. So I hire a sales agent and he's selling all the time. If I ask him to go to a supermarket, he's like, no, I'm selling and you pay me my commission, so I'm going to sell. I don't care, right? If you hire a programmer, they just program. They don't do anything else. They just program. So in stage 3, now you have to hire managers or leaders of specialists. As an example, I have a customer success department with around 6 people. Last year, I hired a woman called Diana. She comes from American Express. She was the head of a department of customer success in American Express Mexico with 80 team members. How much do you think she knows about customer success? 100 times more than me. Do you think I'm going to tell her what to do? No way. Like, she's the boss. Now my job is to coach her and coordinate her with the other departments, but I'm not going to tell her what to do. So in stage 3, it's kind of the adolescent stage. You start deciding what kind of adult you want to be. And you start putting kind of the rules of the operation of a corporation or a company. And it's a very, very stressful stage. Your margins get really, really small or negative. For me, when I went through stage 3, I had to raise $2-3 more million dollars to go through stage 3. It was expensive to go through stage 3. So I've seen very few companies pass stage 3 without a really big loan or raising a lot of money. It's very, very hard to go through stage 3.
Is that because the leaders you bring in demand a market rate that's going to be more than what your company can afford?
One is market rate, but two, they know how to operate with a lot of tools. So my controller came and said, I want SAP. And I was like, you're crazy. It's going to cost me $200,000. And the guy said, if you want to put the systems and processes, I need to have a ERP that is a good one. And I was like, okay, let's do 4 options. And we hired an ERP and it was like $50,000. But every manager asks me for the same things, right? So as an example, we have a lot of our communities in WhatsApp. So whenever we have 1,500 companies and we treat them in WhatsApp and it was manual. So whenever you pay, we have to get your phone and then invite you to a chat. Cuenciano, kitty. Imagine that.
For those who are listening to the podcast, I'm like showing signs of gagging because I hate WhatsApp, and that's usually the first thing I get. Continue.
In Latin America, in Asia, you will live by WhatsApp.
Yeah, I know.
I know. Yeah, in Bali, you have to live by WhatsApp. It's the rule. So we have other communities in WhatsApp, but we have the manual. So imagine when someone pays, you have to get their phone and then invite them manually. But then when they stop paying, you have to go through each of the groups, find the phone number and remove them manually. So when I hire her, she comes to the company like for 2 or 3 months, she comes to me and said like, no more. We're going to disappear the WhatsApp. So when today I have 1,000 companies. Now you want me to have 5,000 in the next 2 years and you want me to do everything manual? No way. So we had to go to WhatsApp Business and then we hire programmers and we connected with Hotspot and our LMS. And so now you pay and automatically you get invited to the group. And then when you don't pay, you get out immediately. Another thing, and that cost me $50,000, $70,000 to do, technologically speaking, to connect everything. Another one, we do a lot of our classes in Zoom. So people were giving Zoom to everyone in their company. No way. We have to have a unique Zoom for every person. The only way to get to our Zooms is when you get to the platform and you have to click on your class in the Zoom and that's going to take you. That you have to connect it, cost you another $50,000 to do. So it's not just their salary. It's just the tools they demand to do it. And interestingly, so like 2-3 months ago, I was watching one of the chats and someone that is not in the chat of the class that we're teaching is in a different chat and he's asking, hey, send me the Zoom of that because I won't take that class. So I text to the guy in private and said, he's not part of that group. So that's why we put the Zoom in the chat. That is the group that you're paying. You're not paying that group, so you don't have access. And the guy said, yeah, but they've always sent it to me, so I want the group. So he told me he was stealing from me, and I confronted him, and he was like, yeah, normal, right? So I told him, if you want to have access to that, you have to pay for that. And the guy said, no, I don't want to pay for that. And I was like, but you're telling me you're stealing from me. And the guy said, yeah, and I want to continue stealing from you. And I was like, no. That's why I'm putting all the systems together, right? But those are the costs that you have to invest to build a platform if you want to get to 10,000, 20,000 companies. That's just the rules of the game.
So, Daniel, right now we talked about 3 different stages. And what I need to know from you is what are the metrics that lets you know which stage I'm at?
Number of employees, 100%. Because the amount of employees that you have is the amount of drama, communication problems, and things like that. And the higher the stage, the more sophisticated leaders you need to have in each of the stages, and they were more expensive. So the way I see stages is layers of management, if you want to call it. So stage 1, 1 to 5, right? Everyone reports to you, but you're doing everything. Like people are kind of there holding your hand, but you're selling, buying, doing the accounting, fighting with the bank, you're doing everything.
This sounds like that startup, like in a garage and like everybody's pulling together. And that's like the romantic idea of entrepreneurship seems to be a bunch of friends getting together and making something happen.
Super romantic, but it's horrible. It is.
Because they're trying to find product market fit. So like you're struggling, you're eating peanuts, but you're all in this together.
If you remember all the movies from Steve Jobs, he started doing motherboards and then he did this. And then he went to the Ruri club and no one cared about him. And that's the way you do product market fit, right? Until he got Mark Keller or whatever it was, the guy that put $250,000. And then that's when they rolled up their own product. Before that, they were doing model boards. So that's stage 1.
Now you graduate to stage 2 when you hit a certain number of people or once you found the product market fit?
So usually you find product market fit and you start selling your product more. But then there's a problem more fulfillment and selling it. Now you have proven that the market wants to buy from you. But then you have to build it, right? One thing is that you're selling, you're giving it to the client, you're doing everything. Now you have to build a company. And you have to start putting departments and putting people that are specialists doing their own job and all that. And usually you could get up to 15 people reporting to you directly. There's one that has 1 or 2 that report to them, but he's not really a manager. It's kind of a glorified employee. And you could get 15, 20 people. Once you get to 20, you have to start getting managers, like real managers in the position. And I would say stage 3 goes from 20 to around 80 minimum. When you get to 80, you have enough leaders, and each leader has enough employees for them to be good managers. So for me, the main value of that is between 20 to 80. Once you cross 80, then you get to stage 4. By the way, I call it the scaling phase or the scale phase, because you have three things: product market fit, a predictable revenue model, a predictable way of selling your product. And now you have heads of each of your departments that have built infrastructure for scale, right? Now that we connected WhatsApp and we connected the Zoom and all that, I could go from 1,000 to 10,000 companies, and the system will allow me to. Before I could. Imagine I get 3,000 companies and we continue to do WhatsApps by hand. It's impossible. So in stage 3, while you're building your management, you're building the systems and processes that are scalable. You get to stage 4, that's when you put fuel to the fire and take your company to the next level.
Is stage 4 the final stage?
No, 5. So stage 4 is the scale of phase, gets to around 250, more or less. And the entrepreneur continues to be the center of the operation and kind of scaling it, doing alliances and all that. Once you get to 250, around the 200, 250, you said, this is too much for me. You put a manager or a COO or a president to run the day of the operation, and you become kind of a satellite around the organization. You're there for strategic innovation and things like that, but you don't run your company. Your company is run by someone else. And usually you have to get to around 200 to get to that.
So when I think of that, since you pulled the example to someone like Elon Musk, like Tesla has a CEO, SpaceX has a CEO, and you can go and build these different initiatives and you have great people.
But he was the CEO until the company probably got to 200.
There you go. You know, Daniel, I've had a chance to hear some of your concepts before. I mean, this is not our first chat, but I'm so glad that you've come here on the podcast to share because it's so valuable as a map. And, you know, as I mentioned, I don't know if we were recording, but I am CEO or general manager for an organization that's around the 30 employee mark. And they're hitting the upper limit. They're having these areas where, oh my God, like we don't have a leadership team and there's no managers in place. And now it's like there's a lot of chaos, yet we have the product market fit. We have a bit of predictable revenue, but we haven't been able to break through. And it's been very exciting to me to jump into this position to bring management principles, communication standards, and to bring in some other people that I'm connected to that can build this leadership team. And a lot of what I'm doing actually comes inspired by a lot of the things I've heard from you and other leaders in the field that have been sharing their message and giving some insight on this. And so I'm internally grateful for you to be sharing these kinds of messages with the world. And I know for anybody listening, this is not necessarily a selling episode, but God, when you are understanding these phases, it allows you to go and chase some incredible things and be a part of incredible organizations. You can even understand what level the organization you work for and what stage they're in and the problems that you're witnessing. And it makes you have a lot more compassion for the entrepreneur. And this might be one of the things I might ask is for someone who's a visionary leader, who's just beginning that stage 3 kind of phase.
Get ahead of operations fast. If you're more a visionary and you're not an operator, bring an operator. Fast. Head of operations or whatever, but put someone there that will do the work. The work has to be done.
But the operator is going to be at odds with some of your requests, isn't he?
It happens a lot. The entrepreneur still needs a lot of their brain, their agility, and the manager will manage it. You still need, why you put a manager like the head of operation until 200? You're still building the culture and who you are as a company until you get to 300 employees. So if you cannot do it, I've seen people put up an operations manager, but you have to be very much in contact with. Indeed, I tell them, don't hire someone that is a really, really great operations manager, but you don't know them. Hire someone that you know. It's more important someone that you're going to trust fully than putting someone that is better. Because that communication with the CEO is very important. And if you don't trust them, you won't allow them to do the job. And you've been hearing the founder mode. Go to Silicon Valley in the last couple of years. There was I think Brian Chesky would talk about it first. He calls it founder's mode. All the big technology companies, they put a CEO to run the company. And most of them remove it after some years and came back to run it. If you see Airbnb, it's run again by branches. Google, now they have a good CEO, but after the CEO they had, Eric Schmidt, the Google founders went back and ran it. So it seemed very, very common that they let the company to a professional operator. They run it, they're efficient, they make money, but they destroy the core values, they destroy the operating mind of the company, and the entrepreneur has to come back and redo it. So that's what they call it, founder's mode.
The Steve Jobs example here with Apple going down and Steve Jobs having to come back is probably the prime example I can think of.
But let me tell you a quick story. It's something that happened to me a couple of months ago. I'm in stage three in my company. I'm already coming out, but I'm stage three. And some months ago, we were having some drama with the operation. And one employee came and complained. "Oh, this drama, you're a terrible reader, and I want to talk to you." And I'm like, "Okay, let's have a phone call." So she was telling me everything that was going wrong. And everything that she was saying is what we teach on stage three. So while she was talking, I got a slide and I got stage three slide and whatever and put it in Zoom. And she was like, "Why you showing me stage three?" And I was like, "Can you repeat what you're complaining? This?" And I was like, "It's here." And then this. And I was like, "It's here." And then this. No, it's here. Everything she was complaining was in this slide. So I said, "You're complaining that we're on stage three and we're going exactly what happens on stage three." And she was like, "But it feels really bad." And I was like, "That's why we have a business. Because all the other thousand or million companies, it feels like that, and that's why they come to us." And she was like, "I didn't realize it feels so bad." And I was like, "That's why we have a job." And she was like, "Okay, thank you," and hang up the phone. That was it. I go through the same, like saying, "Yeah, my son, when he's going to be a teenager, he's going to be super nice." No, his hormones are going to go through the roof and it's going to be a lot of drama. You know it's going to be a lot of drama whenever you have a teenager. But you know that that's going to end in 3 or 4 years. So if you're a father, you said, "Yeah, teenager, when he gets to 20, 21, things are going to change." You know it's going to end. If you think your kid's going to stay like that forever, you left them in the street. It's a lot of drama on that stage. It's just common in human beings. In the company, it's the same. What I've heard from my clients, they said, whenever we get to 80 to 100, everything magical starts fixing. Just by magic, things get fixed. Just now, I have a management team and I have enough money and everything to be able to run a club accordingly.
For some reason, when you talk about adolescent phase, the only thing I'm thinking is like, "It's not a phase, Mom." It's like, actually, it is. It's phase three.
It is a phase. It is a phase. And in a company, stage three. And once you get to 80 to 100, everything gets resolved. Indeed. Let me get you one more piece of data. A company in the US, Canada, or developed countries, they do around $120,000 revenue per employee, a service company. Those are around $120,000 revenue per employee a year of revenue. So if you have 80 employees, you're doing around $10 million in revenue. That's when private equity start looking at you. I've been in calls with private equity, with companies that do $4-5 million. It's an amazing company. It's growing really fast, but they're doing $4-5 million. And private equity, "Hey, we love what you're doing. It's incredible. What's your revenue?" $5 million. They don't even say goodbye. "Whenever you get to 10, call me." Hang up. They don't even touch a company below $10 million. Why? Because they know they don't have product market fit, or they don't have a predictable revenue model, or they don't have a management team. And whenever you get to 10, like all the buyers, private equity, everything just starts looking at you, because now you've proven that it's a viable company.
That's some different levels. But yeah, that makes sense. And in that rule of thumb for 120, is that actually shifting a lot because of AI right now?
Yes. I'm talking about the typical service, boring business. Lawyers, doctors, all of that. Yes, with technology, you're exploring that. I have a client in the US, does $8.5 million in revenue with 6 employees. And he's netting like $3 million to his pocket every year. And he's happy. He's super happy.
Now that's a freedom fighter right there.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, when he hired me, he said, "I don't want to change anything to my company. Just help me make sure it stays like this for 10 years. If I get $3 million a check for my company for 10 years, do I need to sell it? No, I just shut it down."
Daniel, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. And thank you on behalf of every single organization that gets to rely on your wisdom that you've chosen the path of a mountain climber, because that is actually raising the tide for all of us to follow in your footsteps and to be able to do some value in the world. And I know you're the one that's going in first and doing it. So I salute you for that. And I will ask you the question I like to ask on my podcast, just because you're on the Selling with Love. What does selling with love mean to you?
It's not selling, it's helping your clients to buy. I think it's a very, very different process. When you sell, you're kind of trying to get your product to your client in an aggressive way, but it's about you. It's not about them. When you help them to buy, it's about them, and you help them and you guide them to the right product for them, usually yours.
If someone's got their appetite wet from this conversation, they want to go deeper, get more resources from you, what would be the best place for them to go?
Growth Institute, we have courses and programs on how to go through stages. I coach personally all the CEOs that go through the program in a group setting, but I coach them in the process on how to scale through the stages, how to navigate each of the stages. And LinkedIn, I post a lot in LinkedIn, and Instagram, danielmarcos.scale is my Instagram in English.
Daniel, thank you again. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. It's been a long time since catching up, and I love that you're spreading these ideas, and I'm excited to see the next stages of your organization as you go into stage four.
Thank you, Rio. Thanks for the invitation.
I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.